Hello, and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 65 for August 31st, 2010. I'm Dominic Ribe, and with me today are
Ben Snitkoff
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. First, Lexmark and HP are using patent law and the International Trade Commission to try to block ink cartridges from competing with them. There's a lawsuit against Facebook for teenagers' eye-liking ads. And finally, People Magazine brings itself to the iPad, and there are certain issues that come along with that. Let's dive right into our first story, which is the HP and Lexmark patent law and international trademark case. And basically, this case is against ink cartridge manufacturer or replacement ink cartridge manufacturers. When you have a laser printer or, well, I guess, yeah, when you have a printer, you need ink for it. And there are companies, mostly actually based in China, as it turns out, that are producing, if you will, compatible cartridges that are work with the HP and Lexmark printers, but are significantly less expensive. HP and Lexmark both have patents on the particular chemical composition of the ink that works in their cartridges, as well as other aspects, but I think this mostly concerns the chemical composition of the ink. And they've been trying to enforce these patents against these companies, and because these companies are usually foreign-based, they have sort of two avenues of attack, if you will. Avenue 1 is the U.S. patent system, and Avenue 2 is the International Trade Commission. And because the ITC is separate from the U.S. patent system, it basically gives HP and Lexmark two tries at bat. If they don't make it through the U.S. patent system, well, okay, they might not be able to say that they're infringing our patent, but you know what, we can use the International Trade Commission and ban them from importing into the United States for unfair trade competition practices, which is effectively accomplishes the same thing. So that's sort of the big picture. Thoughts from our panel on this story?
I guess my first thought is that the ITC proceedings usually come at the same time or just before an actual patent suit. So what is a common way for this to go down is that somebody will file a patent infringement suit in federal court and at the same time or shortly thereafter file a complaint with the International Trade Commission based on that same patent. So saying, you know, we've got a patent in the United States, they're violating this patent, and we're, you know, we've sued in federal court, but we're also bringing this complaint before the ITC. And what happens in at least most of the cases that I'm familiar with is that the federal court where the patent suit has been filed will stay those proceedings until the end of the ITC proceedings, so that there aren't two things going on at the same time. There aren't really two wholly separate suits going on. It's you file both of these suits and you're pursuing one of them before you get to the other, because if the ITC one finishes and is, you know, in favor of the plaintiff, then the remedies that you're going to be asking for in federal court, if you then go back to that, are much different.
Sure, but the failure of one suit doesn't preclude the other one from continuing, right?
That is correct. So you could have two bites at the apple, but it's not, I don't see it as devious as Mike Masnick seems to think this is. It's not like they're going one route, and then when that route fails, they're going the other route. They're making this choice in the beginning that they're essentially going to take both routes. At least in most of the
right.
cases, they take both routes and proceed in a fashion that's completely typical. And it's not like the ITC is the last say in patent law anyway. You know, the ITC is usually the proceeding that happens first, and their opinions have absolutely no binding effect on the enforceability of the patent.
Right. Lexmark, interestingly, has apparently turned to patents as their weapon of choice to try to combat ink cartridge manufacturers, because before, I think we covered a story a couple months ago where they used the DMCA and copyright law to stop these guys.
Well, that was a much older case, I think, from several years ago, if I remember correctly. But yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, maybe
they tried to use
the case that I learned in law school. Something we covered. It's all blurring together.
They tried to use the DMCA to basically affect the same type of thing through copyright law, and what they were doing was placing an authentication chip which would somehow be able to detect whether or not an ink cartridge had been manufactured by Lexmark. And apparently some folks got a hold of this when they were trying to either refill the ink on the cartridges themselves or create their own cartridge that would fit into the interface. And what Lexmark eventually claimed was that it was a violation of the anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA because they had effectively circumvented an access control. The court, though, said that no way, that's not actually an access control because it's not protecting anything that is protected by copyright law. So that was probably the reason that we talked about it, and I think we talked about it on our show related to the DMCA exemptions.
Yeah, we've definitely talked about that case before, but it is an older case. What's interesting is that there's a concurring opinion in that case, which essentially said that the judge, so two of the judges, all three judges were agreed in the result that this wasn't a DMCA violation. One judge went further to say that not only would I say that this isn't a violation of the DMCA in this case, I would also say that you can never use the DMCA to prohibit access to functionality, as opposed to prohibiting access to copyrighted materials, because copyright law just doesn't protect functionality. Sadly, that has not been adopted more broadly, but I think it's a very reasonable position that judge took.
So another interesting part of all of this is that there was another case, I think, in 2005, and I can't remember the name of this case, but it had to deal with contract aspects of ink cartridges, and I think Lexmark at one point had a requirement that after you expend a ink cartridge, you have to send it back to Lexmark, rather than if you were to take it and send it to, say, a third party who could refill it and you could reuse it. And I think Lexmark actually won that case on the basis of contract law, if I remember correctly. It has been a while since I read that opinion, though. So although you can't get the protection under the DMCA for copyright stuff, you might be able to get it through some sort of service agreement or a contract. But considering this case has to do mostly with patent law, maybe you guys want to opine on what the effects of this case might be under patent law?
Just a quick note about the case that you're referencing. That's a 2005 Ninth Circuit case called Arizona Cartridge Remanufacturers versus Lexmark. Basically, it's as you said that the consumer agreed basically to the contract, and it was purely a contract law, basically the shrink wrap license, if you will, sort of.
Yes, that's right.
So as for patent law, I mean, we'll see. It's very hard to enforce patents against, it can be difficult to enforce, this is an enforcement of U.S. patents in America, so it'll definitely work in the states, but, for example, they're not going to have any luck enforcing this. It's going to be very difficult for them to have much luck enforcing this in China, just because of the way the system works there. It's gotten a lot better, but it's still very difficult and costly to enforce U.S. patents in China, even if there has been what's called the PCT, the Patent Cooperation Treaty. It's basically a way of standardizing cross-filing, so that if you have a U.S. patent and you want to file it in China, you can use a PCT sort of filing methodology to sort of make that process run a little more smoothly. But as for just patent law in the U.S., I mean, it's going to go the same way most things go. They'll probably try to either infringe the patent by showing prior art or obviousness. They're going to try to invalidate the patent by showing prior art or obviousness, and at the same time arguing that they're not infringing the patent after all. So you can make all these arguments at once, basically, just because of the way the legal system works. You can say, well, I mean, first, we're not infringing. But if we are, the patent's invalid. But if it's valid, then it's invalid for it, or it's obvious. And so you have all that sort of sequential line of arguments that you make at once.
Oh, so I guess you could say that the ink manufacturers are getting two bites at the apple. First, they're being able to say that the patent that they're not infringing the patent, and then if that doesn't work, they can say that the patent's invalid.
You could make that argument if you're unskilled in the field of the law, but yeah. But no, I see your sort of analogy in the ITC direction that it's a slightly different thing, right? Because importing things into the country is different than infringing a patent, so.
And my beef with that characterization that it's two bites at the apple is that they're two completely different mechanisms to affect different results. Yes, in the end they'd both have the effect of, preventing competition, but that's kind of an inapt way of characterizing what's going on here. I mean, it's the same way as saying that using the ICANN UDRP to take over a domain name and using the Anti-Cyber-Squatting Consumer Protection Act are two bites of the app. They're just two completely different systems. I don't know. Vilify these companies for making ink very expensive and for doing this in the first place. Don't vilify them for using every method available to try to enforce their patents.
Well, the one thing that we should probably talk about with regard to this industry is that is the business model, and it's a lot like Gillette razors or any other brand of disposable razor, whereby you go out, you buy the razor for very cheap, sometimes even cheaper than it costs to physically make the item and ship it to the store, and then the real money to be made is in buying the replacement blade cartridges. The same goes for printers. Often you get a printer for a relatively cheap amount in some cases. That's not true in every case, but it could be true in a lot of cases, and then you're going to pay $30 or $40 to get the ink cartridge refills. And that's how these companies plan to make money, and they also see it as a business proposition looking into the future, because for the most part, printers are relatively durable too, although we do get some technical advancements as we move forward. They don't seem to be anything too staggering that is enough to make people upgrade their printer every single year. So, the way that they, one way they, at least that they look to make money is through the ink cartridge system.
Yeah, and this is called the two-price tariff in economics, and it's been around forever. I mean, the old punch card machines, IBM punch card machines, you'd get the machine for a reduced price, and you'd contract to buy all of your punch cards from IBM. And I'm sure these things have been around forever, and sometimes they violate antitrust law, and sometimes they don't. But I don't think we should be. I mean, and I'm disagreeing with the vast majority of what you're saying, David. It's the again, my real only beef here is that we're saying, how dare they get two bites at the apple first trying to file an ITC complaint and then a federal lawsuit.
Oh.
It's that just that characterization bugs me. But otherwise, I think I agree with what we're talking about and what we're saying, that generally it sucks. But it's something that's been around for a while, and it's annoying.
Yeah, no, I was really just pointing out that it has been around for a while. Of course, it does not necessarily mean that it's a great business model. I, for one, definitely like to see more competition in certain industries.
Yeah, do we know, and I couldn't tell this from the articles that we're basing this on, are these patents based on the composition of the inks, or are they based on something in the ink cartridge itself, like some feature of how the ink is dispensed?
It's not clear to me, honestly, because I can't find articles that actually link to the patents that are being asserted or to the complaint so I can figure out what patent is being asserted.
Yeah, and there you could have some merit. Like, I know, and I don't think these are the printers that we're really concerned about, but companies like HP have been putting a lot of time and money in research and probably getting very valid patents into inks that can expand the color gamut that printers can print because, and I never realized this until recently, but better ink sets will actually produce, not only better colors, but a wider range of colors that, you can perceive on the paper. And this is mostly with the very high-end photo printers, the kind of thing where you're probably going to be opting for the manufacturer's ink anyway. But there is a valid claim that some of these compositions of ink should be protected by patents. However, if it's just, some feature in the actual ink cartridge, I think that's a more difficult argument.
Yeah, for one of the cases, because HP has brought a lot of these cases against a lot of different people, but they brought one case in particular against this company called InkCycle, which basically takes an ink cartridge and refills it with more ink. They asserted three patents against these guys. I actually found a story that links to the patent, so I can tell you what they are. One patent deals with how the ink dries. So it makes sense that it dries quickly and it doesn't smear and it looks awesome. And the reason they could infringe this is because they're basically taking ink that goes into the cartridge, and they're basically doing they're recreating the ink that HP uses and putting it into a cartridge and then selling these refilled cartridges, if you will. So they're infringing on the ink because they're just making ink that infringes on the patent, and then putting it back into the cartridge that HP made. They're not making the cartridge, they're just putting it back into it, and then selling that. So, and another patent is, like you said, for color printing, like color preventing color bleed, again, with the ink. And then another patent is also with regard to color bleed in inkjet. So.
So for that first patent, a fast-drying ink, there was actually, I assume, at least some guidelines as to the composition of that ink, like
yes,
8
for example,
to 15% this, 8 to 15% that, 10
yes,
to
a small 20%. Amount of alcohol, 0.05 to 6% per weight, is added to water-based inks for thermal inkjet printer. That
it drives
range.
Me up a wall. It drives me up a wall that you can get a patent on something that's the composition of which is 0.05 to 6% by weight something. That doesn't enable your invention. That enables a broad range of things that may or may not encompass your invention.
But that's the art of claim drafting, right? To secure the largest amount of claim space, regardless whether... your invention is inside the claim space, but you claim far beyond your invention. You try to claim to the essence of what your invention solves, to anticipate of what other inventions might be out there so that they will infringe your patent and you can get money for them.
Yeah, That's very true, and it's a quirk of the patent system. It's just a quirk of the patent system that I dislike, and therefore rail against on this podcast.
It makes perfect sense that you would dislike it, and you're certainly free to rail against it. I'm sure it entertains our listeners. All right. With that, anything else on this story?
All set.
One last thing. I think there's a couple of tenets of antitrust law which play into patent law, and I'm not quite as familiar with them, but I know that you can raise them as defenses at certain points in patent infringement. So basically you claim that the person asserting that you are infringing a patent can then say, well, hey, you're actually violating antitrust law by either tying your patent invention together with something else, and that it might amount to something that restricts trade. So it's possible that those things could come up in this lawsuit as well.
Yeah, the interesting thing is a lot of the time in sort of multi-patent situations, you'll have companies with effectively conflicting patents, and they agree that, you know what, I'm not going to sue you, you're not going to sue me, because we would both lose. And so nothing happened. But moving on to our next story.
Yes, our next story this week is all about Facebook, and a new lawsuit was filed in California, in the state court in California, actually, down in L.A., that asserts that Facebook is misappropriating the commercial likenesses of minors with their I Like button that you can click on ads. Now, a lot of people are probably familiar with some of the stories that have circulated over the last year that Facebook basically wants to add like buttons all around the internet. And one area that they've sought to revolutionize was advertising, and by placing the like button on ads, people can click them and it basically creates a method of targeting ads more specifically to an individual user, whereas in normal advertising, when you don't really have a strong profile on who is using or who's using a computer at a time or who's browsing the internet, using a like button then would help generate this information for certain advertisers and allow them to target the ads more specifically to them. So there's lots of reasons that companies like this, but Facebook's may have run into some problems here, because there are people who use Facebook who are under the age of 18. As far as I know, Facebook registration is completely open now, except for people under the age of 13. So you have a range of folks who are 14 to 17 who might be using the service. And according to this lawsuit, if you are clicking on the ads and you are in that age range and you happen to live in California, Facebook might be violating a commercial misappropriation statute, which basically says that without the consent of a person, you can't misappropriate a person's likeness for commercial purposes. Well, they're also saying that since these people are minors in this case, because they're between the ages of 14 and 17, therefore you would need to have parental consent in order to use the commercial likeness. And as soon as you click on it, it goes back to your feed, which gets dispersed to all the people who are in your network. And because of that, then what you're doing is basically applying a person's like, and it's like misappropriating their commercial likeness or their likeness and using it for a commercial purpose. So this is a pretty interesting suit, and the statute is a pretty nuts and bolts type of a commercial misappropriation statute in California. What do you guys think?
LOL.
I feel like
phrase it
this
in
isn't
modern
the
language.
Yeah, I feel like this isn't the first time an argument like this has been raised. I seem to remember people first talking about this during the Beacon program, where Facebook very briefly tied the rest of the internet to your Facebook account. So whenever you bought something, I think it was on Overstock or rented a video on Netflix,
Blockbuster.
or I think it was Blockbuster, not Netflix,
Yeah.
it would then show up on your Facebook feed. And people raised concerns in addition to some claims under the Video Rental Privacy Act, the official name of which I can't remember. But there's a statute that gave you some privacy with regard to what videotapes you rented, or in this case DVDs. They also raised concerns that this would be essentially misappropriation of your likeness for advertising on Facebook, because if your picture shows up next to a product, if you bought it, that's not necessarily an endorsement for the sake of an ad.
It might not be, but let's say it is. And every time you sign up for Facebook, you have to agree to the terms of service, their license agreement, and within their license agreement, they have, of course, the privacy policy. And it lays out a lot of this stuff, and it says, by the way, from time to time, we're going to give your information off to advertisers. And it, of course, gives permissions for them to do things like this program. The problem, according to this lawsuit, is the age range that Facebook, of the users that on Facebook who are doing this. It's not so much the fact that they are just sharing the information to other people within the network. And
Right, and this is a decent claim, especially as it relates to children, because children are offered more protection on the internet and more protection with regard to, entering into contracts and things like that than other people. And you'd have to wonder if this would apply to anyone under the age of 18 too, because of their inability to enter into legally binding contracts. I don't know off the top of my head if Facebook requires that a parent enter into, once you sign up, does a parent also have to click "I agree to these things"?
well, I did look into this, of course, before the show, and the answer to that is no. The only restriction that I saw in the terms of service are that if you're under the age of 13, or I think if you're 13 or under, you cannot sign up for a Facebook account. And that restriction is actually a requirement under the FTC's, what's it,
COPPA.
the COPPA laws. Yeah.
COPPA? I don't know how to pronounce it. Children's Online Privacy Protection Act.
That it and it's not that you can't have children under the 13 or under sign up. It's that if you do that, you would need parental consent in those circumstances. I think in the form of an email address or a written letter, even. But that's not really an issue here because we're talking about people 14 to 17, and I don't know the specifics on contract law in California, especially with regard to age of majority type arguments, but it would be interesting to hear if just because they're under 7 or just because they're under 18 doesn't mean they can't enter into these types of contracts, because they're doing this willingly, or at least presumably willingly. They had the contract put in front of them at one point, and they clicked "I agree" before they created their accounts.
Almost no one reads those contracts, honestly. Even lawyers don't.
You're so right, and that is very sad too. I am guilty of doing exactly that a lot of the times throughout the day when I've got a million things to do. I'm going to a website, and one of these documents is thrust in front of me. And as long as it's I'm not doing this for something related to work, I just click right through without reading it. But nonetheless, courts don't really accept that as a valid argument, or at least they haven't up to this point.
Right, for Facebook's part, they have come out and said that the complaint, the lawsuit here, misunderstands the law and how Facebook works, and that, for example, so apparently the complaint alleges that the result of this will be teenagers marketing Facebook and related wares through search engines, but Facebook, and this is so far I can, as far as I can tell, the only argument that they've come out publicly and stated, this is. The reason we're not liable for, these violations of the law is because children's profiles, in fact, do not show up in public search engines, which seems to only go to one of the many claims levied here. But, obviously Facebook doesn't want to show their hand entirely this early in the litigation.
So I, for one, I'm just absolutely intrigued by this because I want to see where this goes. There could be a very simple fix to this, and that could be if Facebook goes in and modifies some of the language within the terms of service agreement to basically they could modify it so that a person who is between the ages of 14 and 17 would need some sort of parental consent in order to participate in like button like activities on Facebook. That might be a little bit too complicated. If you need to provide the parental consent, you might also want to get the parent's email address. But there could be other things, such as just restricting this feature to people within that general age range, since you do have to provide your birthday when you sign up for Facebook. That would be another thing that they could do.
The simple solution that I'd be happy to see is just make it so you can't like ads.
But recently in Facebook, there's been a blurring between advertisements and non-advertisements. For example, let's say I'm a big fan of the band The Decemberists. I can now go and like The Decemberists. But am I liking an ad, or am I liking The Decemberists? And where that seems like a really blurry line.
That the ad will link to their page, basically, without... So it's not really liking the ad so much as liking the ad triggers liking the page?
No. I'm just saying, if I like a group, a band, how is that different from lending my likeness to an advertisement? Or because the band is in itself a commercial entity.
Yeah, I see your point. So then why is this lawsuit about ads and not the broader issue?
Maybe their lawyers aren't as clever as I am.
Aha!
I think ads are the most obvious instance where you would find this. Anything else might start to become tenuous in terms of... this is a class action lawsuit, so the ads would certainly apply to everybody who has clicked an ad that's between those ages. So does anyone want to give their opinion on the merits, or is this just another one of these silly lawsuits?
Looks a lot like a silly lawsuit.
It looks like a duck. It smells like a duck. What do you think, Ben?
I don't know. It doesn't strike me as completely meritless, but it strikes me as the kind of thing that, in the end, Facebook will make some sort of settlement probably before the class gets certified, and change one or two things in the way that liking ads works, or that the liking system works in general, in an effort to appease the lawyers. Because I can't think of a single instance where Facebook hasn't settled out one of these suits.
Well, for a company that seems to have a very high valuation mark attached to it, but not actually a whole lot of liquid cash sitting around, it's kind of difficult to tell when they implicate an entire class, even though this is just a class of persons in California. But I bet you're probably right. This will get settled out of court. It does sound like there might be some merit to some of these claims, and it would be really difficult for judges to deal with this, since the whole concept of social networking has sort of changed the way that people use the internet fundamentally over the last 5 years. So trying to apply some of the more traditional misappropriation of commercial likeness norms to an instance like this just might prove to be too difficult for a judge to handle it.
Good point. Any last thoughts before we move on to the next story? Dominic?
All set.
David?
Take it away.
Okay, so our last story this week is People Magazine. People Magazine announced that they were going to be releasing an iPad app, and very shortly thereafter announced that they would be delaying the release of their iPad app. And then I think it was August 19th, so about 2 weeks ago, actually finally released this application. Now, the holdup was that they use a lot of images, specifically images taken by paparazzi, in their magazine, you know, pictures of celebrities on the street, pictures of celebrities at various, you know, restaurants, at weddings, things like that. And the problem was that People Magazine had licensed use of these pictures for their website and for their print media, but they had not obtained a specific license for using them on mobile devices. And the photographers, specifically, I think the agencies representing these photographers, raised quite a stink about it, saying, you know, if you're going to use it for something that you haven't licensed it for, you should probably pay us for them. So I guess the first thing that I want to talk about is when we speak of copyrights, we often talk of like a bundle of rights that you can split up as you will. And we'll put a link to this in the show notes, but those bundles of rights come from 17 USC 106. It's called exclusive rights in copyrighted works, and those are generally to reproduce the copyrighted work, to prepare derivative works, to distribute copies of that work to the public by sale, transfer of ownership, by rental, lease, or lending. In some cases, you're going to have the right to perform that work publicly. That'll be things for literary works, musical works, dramatic, choreographed works, pantomimes, motion pictures, or audiovisual works. You'll also have the right to display that work publicly in addition to performing it. And so that's about it. Those are the main rights that we see. But in those rights there, I don't see, there's the right to display the work publicly. Okay. So if I give somebody the right to display my work publicly, that seems to take care of publishing in a newsprint or putting it on a web page. So, what's going on here? How are these people, if they've already given People Magazine the right to display this publicly, how are they now claiming that if they want to display it publicly more, they need to pay photographers more money?
I think it comes down to the nuts and bolts of the license agreement, and I don't have you. Do we have a copy of the license agreement before us anywhere?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, but from what I understand, it's pretty common in the sort of media area to just license to say like we license you to use our copyrighted material for the purposes of a print magazine and online media. And let's say they signed this license agreement 5 years ago before anyone really expected an iPad to be real and successful. Is an iPad online media? People Magazine is going to argue, no way. Or, sorry, People Magazine is going to argue, yeah, an Apple's online media, iPad is online media. What else is it? I mean, it's online and it's media. It's online media. Where the paparazzi union or the agency, I'm not sure what they are exactly, sorry. They're going to argue that it's absolutely not online media. It's a completely different device. We never meant to license that to them for use on an iPad, and we didn't say you can use it in print magazine, online media, or the iPad and other mobile devices. We just said, so you should pay us more money for the iPad. So it comes down to that.
Right, so I think what I'm trying to get at here is that not only can you divide up those rights the way I enumerated them, but you can further divide up any one of those rights. You can limit it by scope as far as you can license these photos for the web, you can license them for print media, you can license them for even a specific amount of time. Like, you will have an exclusive right to print these photographs for these 2 weeks, and then I can license them to whomever else I want. And the copyright is really an extremely flexible right in how the author or the person who created the work and what they can do with it.
Yeah, I mean, part of the joys and wonders of good license agreement is good license agreement drafting is anticipating future technologies and future uses, getting the other party to agree to them without telling them about them, but getting the language in so that they agree to it. In other words, say that People Magazine had a very crafty license agreement and they had said online media, paper, and other mobile devices, or some sort of way of encapsulating the idea of the iPad and similar devices without actually spelling it out. And so, or
Right.
for example, for any other form of electronic display. Oh, like, okay, well, that seems like that covers the iPad more broadly than online media does.
This
Or
is,
electronic media.
yeah, this would be what I like to call specificity and precision of drafting in contract language, and it's a pure art. There's some people out there who can do it really well and take all these things into consideration. And this is often what happens in contract negotiations between opposing parties who are trying to draw together the terms of the contract. On one hand, you've got business interests which might want the contract to be produced much faster with less precise language. And on the other hand, you often have the lawyers who are thinking about all the implications if you don't draw out things very specific to what you hope that the uses will be of a copyrighted work. And for that reason, you can have a contract which can be on one hand 3 to 5 pages and be somewhat specific, but not overly specific about what the rights are that are being transferred between the parties. And on the other hand, you could have something about the exact same transaction that is more like 30 to 40 pages. And I have seen those in practice, and they get insanely complex when it comes down to the rights that are divvied out to the other party.
Yeah, I don't normally do transactional work, but when I do, I've always, taken a look at what I want to say in the contract and then write it up from there, and then afterward go back, and if I need to make things a little more specific here and there, I do it. But in the end, I almost always end up cutting stuff out and, combining sections because and trying to make the contract as brief as possible. Because otherwise, it just becomes incomprehensible, and you start, accidentally adding things in later that contradict things that come earlier in the contract, and it just becomes a huge mess. So, I'm a big fan of both easy to read and short contracts.
Hopefully, so we don't get too far off track, off topic here, but doing those types of contracts between sophisticated parties who actually have bargaining power, like two different sets of lawyers, is much different than, say, writing a contract for a website or something along the lines where you need a person who does not have familiarity with the law to understand what their rights are. But good points though, Ben.
In this case, though, the bargaining is between essentially a photo agency, which is going to be a savvy,
Several photo agencies, actually, it
yeah,
turns out,
several
like big
photos.
one.
Yeah, and People Magazine. So it's not like this is between Joe Schmo and People Magazine. These are going to be two savvy competitors who are going to understand what's going on in both of these cases.
Yeah. So it seems like People Magazine might potentially try to use it. Apparently, I've dug a little bit more on this license. There's a clause in the license agreement that says that allows for promotional repurposing, and they could try to argue that the iPad app is actually a promotional repurpose. They're definitely going to argue it's exactly the same as the print version, but I believe the app is free, but then you have to pay to download issues of the magazine, or is it pay? I'm not entirely sure how it works, but there's some way of money given to People Magazine right away.
Yeah, so it's free for people who subscribe to the magazine, and then I'm not sure what it is for people who don't subscribe, but there is a way to get it. I think it's $3.99 an issue, but I don't know whether the app's free and you pay for each issue or you pay for each issue separately as an individual app. My guess is the app's free and then you pay for each issue.
Let's see what the iTunes store says. Yes, the app is free. And then you pay for each issue. So, in fact, the in-app purchases are $3.99 each for each issue that you want to buy.
Yeah, the other interesting thing that could happen here is imagine if People Magazine, I don't know if they've got a iPhone or iPad compatible web page, but what if the iPad app was basically just a wrapper on the web page? Would that have then fallen
Yeah.
into licensing for the internet?
That's
Yeah, I think
unclear.
there's a very decent argument that that would be the case then, but creating an app that, accesses that data differently and displays it in a different way may give rise to a new usage.
Definitely could. I mean, again, it would come down to what language was actually used in that contract. And whenever I have seen any provisions that relate to any kind of electronic use of any copyrighted work, it's usually a paragraph that is almost a quarter to a half of a page big in terms of the definition of what electronic use means. So you could, on one hand, be talking about something that was very specifically defined, and on the other, not so much. You could just be at computers and the internet and laptops, or might not even contemplate mobile devices.
Any last thoughts on this, Dominic?
It seems like they've actually done a good job with the app itself, making it very much an iPad-y experience from everything I've read about it. They didn't just wrap around the website. They made it something as true to the magazine as they could while still sort of embracing the unique advantages of the iPad platform itself. So it for the purposes that the photographer agencies might be arguing, it is very much a different thing. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out because this is a really big magazine and it'll probably set sort of the standard for how things go as more and more publishers try to move to the iPad.
Yep. David, any last thoughts?
Just because it's just like Dominic said, it's really interesting just because of the sheer volume of people who seem to read People magazine. So I'd be interested to see where this goes and how the transactional lawyers end up handling this. But my guess is that we probably won't hear about what the exact resolution is in terms of the contract language, since those things are usually private between parties.
Okay, in that case, I would like to thank you all for joining us for this episode of the Technically Legal Podcast. As always, you can visit us on our website, www.technicallylegal.org, or email us, podcast@technicallylegal.org, with any comments or suggestions that you may have. So with me this week were
Dominic Rabbi.
And David O'Brien.
And I'm Ben Snickoff. Thank you for joining us.